Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by the Coriell Institute for Medical Research.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. In communities all over America, people are trying to find ways to fight the opioid addiction crisis, which is ripping apart families and destroying lives.
You were so humble, so kind.
Memorials like this one, held for Juan Ramos on a street corner in Philadelphia, have become commonplace.
I seen him before he died, and I told him, Juan, please, get out of the street, please.
Juan's body was discovered in the brush not far away. The medical examiner determined he died of an overdose.
Juan, it was a friend of mine, but I think I failed him, and the system did too.
Tens of thousands of Americans are dying each year because of opioid overdoses.
Communities across the country are desperate to find ways to prevent these deaths.
Alana Gordon has been covering the opioid crisis for The Pulse.
And that means training residents in how to use naloxone. It's a medication that can reverse an overdose. But the reality is people who are addicted to illegal drugs often use in hiding in unsafe situations alone. And that means that that help may arrive too late.
So now, cities from Philadelphia and New York to San Francisco and Seattle are considering something else, supervised injection sites. These are places where people can bring illicit drugs and inject them with medical staff present in case of an overdose. This is not a push to get people to quit. This is about reducing deaths.
In the public health world, this is an approach that's often called harm reduction. But this is uncharted territory in the United States. It's controversial. Technically, it's illegal because it goes against federal drug laws. And many communities are confused, fearful, and pushing back.
And I feel like we're telling people to just stay on drugs, keep ruining your life. It just doesn't make sense to me. It's nothing but a crutch. It's enabling people.
Tensions have been boiling over, like at this public meeting in Philadelphia not too long ago.
We don't need one of these sites in my neighborhood. I don't.
That's right.
They also need to protect the community. They need to protect my son, you know?
But these sites already exist in Australia, in Europe, and in Vancouver, Canada. They've had such a place for 15 years. It's North America's first public supervised injection facility, and it's called InSite.
And this place has been inundated with questions and visits from curious U.S. city leaders and addiction specialists.
San Francisco has been up here en masse. I think some folks from Colorado have been interested as
New York,
well.
New York sent up some reps from their police.
The mayor of Ithaca was up, who is ridiculously young.
And so on today's show, Maiken, I wanted The Pulse to take a trip to the source of all this buzz.
And ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to welcome you to Vancouver. Local time is approximately...
Let's go inside InSite and explore the region's entire approach to preventing drug deaths. We're going to talk to lots of people. Some of them didn't want to use their names because of their illicit drug use.
And your story starts right in the part of the city where InSite is located.
I first want to get to know the surrounding neighborhood, so I meet up with a local journalist, Travis Lupik.
This is the corner of Main and Hastings, which is sort of the epicenter of the whole thing.
We're in the middle of Vancouver's downtown east side. The whole area is a hub for drugs.
That open drug market has operated for 30, 40 years.
Travis points to a big community center across the street from us and a group of people dealing drugs out front.
Another half dozen of them behind us, and it's been this way for literally decades.
This main avenue is wide, but can be hard to walk through in certain parts that are thick with people and people's things and things people are selling. DVDs. Dream catchers.
Golf clubs. Got a New York Giants shirt on for sale also.
Vancouver's a port city with mild winters, so all this street activity is just a stone's throw from the water and a beautiful mountain view. I'm seeing like some really nice condominiums back there, it looks like.
Yeah, it's funny. The poorest postal code in Canada, the moniker that the downtown east side often takes, literally overlaps the most expensive neighborhood in Vancouver, Gastown, just one block north of us.
Travis just wrote a book about the history of supervised injection in Vancouver. It's called Fighting for Space. As we walk, he points to lots of single-room occupancy hotels.
Rundown, shared bathrooms.
The area has lots of homelessness, but also lots of social service agencies and shelters. The big businesses that were once there shuttered decades ago, making way for poverty and drugs and pain of all kinds. Right here in the middle of this is InSight, the supervised injection site. I meet Benji along the way there.
Myself, I was actually clean for 10 years, and then I buried my dad, and then I just kind of fell down from there, and I've just been down here ever since, right? So
Benji tells me he's a regular at InSight.
I think that they're great, right? There'd be a lot more people dead without them.
People may go to InSight to inject drugs multiple times a day. It's often not about getting high, but to avoid getting sick from withdrawal, or avoid using dirty supplies behind dumpsters and alleys. Open for service 9 a.m. to 2 a.m. This storefront can be easy to miss if you're not looking for it. The name InSight's printed in white on the window. No big sign. The morning I stop by, Tim and Darwin, two of the guys who help run this place, are outside. They're huddled over a man who's not looking so good.
Can you hold your hands up like this? Can you hold your hands up like this?
The man slumped over against the building. He's okay. He's able to talk a little. I follow Tim and Darwin inside. Okay, so what just happened?
So we checked that fella for an overdose event, mostly because of his posture. It wasn't really his color or anything, but just the way he was slumped forward, it's just kind of concerning. So we went out to see.
It wasn't an overdose, but they also knew the man, and unprompted, he asked them about detox.
Yeah, and that's very typical. That's usually how those kind of things play out.
Tim Goche is a nurse and clinical coordinator here. He says detox is an easy request to respond to, because short-term detox beds and longer-term recovery services are located right upstairs. Darwin Fisher is InSight's program coordinator and says this place has always been in the thick of where people who use drugs are.
After about 2-3 million visits that we've had, it looks mildly shop-worn, but it's not by any means grody.
The region's health authority oversees InSight. I'm not allowed to record people injecting, but Tim and Darwin have time to walk me through how it all works before the place opens.
So everybody waits in the reception and wait room. This open concept space, and then we'll call them in one at a time as their name comes up. So
the front room is simple, a few chairs, a counter, and a sink.
So accessing something as basic as running water is a really important part of this.
People share a small amount of information when they sign in, like what kind of drug they're using. And then they give a code name, like Peaches, or Mischief, or Misfit. That's all by design. Darwin says the less bureaucratic, the better. The point is to make people comfortable, so they want to come inside. And that way, everyone can focus on developing relationships.
And H-Bomb's here.
While we're talking, a guy thrusts his body against the front window.
Good morning, H-Bomb. Love you.
To say hi.
Yep. As they will do sometimes, people can be really extroverted around here in a good way. It's nice to create a space where people can do that, where they can kind of feel that love and exchange that love. It's part of what this place and this space is about. Not just about keeping people alive, though that is absolutely the primary goal. It's about making a space where drug users are allowed to feel like people.
We head to the back room, the inner sanctum for supervised injection. It's a big space with 13 cubicles against the wall. A little bit like a hair salon.
It's kind of like a mirrored cubicle with high walls with spotlighting over top of each booth. The rest of the room is fairly dim lit, except for the staff stations.
There's a side room for health visits and wound care, plus an area in the middle where people can get clean injection supplies, sterile water, needles. How long can people stay here?
We do not have time limits on booths. People may need time to use safely for various reasons. We're also mindful that this is a respite from the street, and at times it may be tough for people to leave the only situation that feels vaguely safe for them in a day.
It's quiet now, but Darwin says once 9 a.m. hits, the energy shifts. Music plays out of speakers over a low hum of conversations, hellos, goodbyes. People settle into their individual booths, unpack the drugs they brought, and do their thing, prepping and injecting it. It's a ritual that happens hundreds of times here each day, taking 5 minutes or maybe 25.
And nurses in particular, like when somebody is struggling with their injection, like we can see that they're getting frustrated or agitated, you know, kind of poking or stabbing away at themselves. It's our responsibility to go and check in and see if we can help make that safer for them and find like a safer vein or a better access point.
Staff won't poke anyone's skin or push drugs in, but they will suggest better spots and offer injection advice. Other staffers stand back to keep an eye on what's going on. Like lifeguards, they're looking out for anyone who might be in trouble.
I shouldn't have lived.
It's like an out-of-body experience.
It's almost like getting in an accident.
Like, you feel like...
go to sleep, and when you wake up, you're...
taken back by it.
Surrounded by people who are incredibly concerned with you.
Did you want to overdose?
Never. Well, sorry. There were times in my past where I did want to overdose, but I certainly didn't go to Insight to do it. If you want to die, you don't go somewhere where nobody has died.
That was Dylan Reimet, Rhea Jane, and Daniel Beaverstock. They've all overdosed and used Insight. Tim Goche, the head nurse, says unless someone is experiencing other health problems, he rarely has to call for paramedics.
No one's ever died here or at any other supervised consumption site worldwide.
He and others are well-versed in responding. Here's what they do.
So typically in an opioid overdose, we're going to see somebody who looks like they're sleeping or they're unresponsive, they're pale or not breathing. We can't wake them up. So we're going to go over to them, to their booth right away. We're going to try and stimulate them with our voice first. So we're going to use loud voice. We're going to call them by their name to try and get them up. And then before we touch anybody, which is really in respect to people's trauma histories, we don't want to touch anybody without getting their consent first. So we'll bang on the table, we'll knock on the desk to try and give them a bit of vibration and loud noise. And then oftentimes we're going to kick the chair. To anybody who's watching that event, it looks super rude. But in practice, it's actually, we have a lot less people who are triggered by somebody being touched. So usually we'll kick or tap the chair and just ask them to wake up. Pick up your head, pick up your head. If they're not responding to that, then we move in with touch. Usually it's a firm pressure applied to the shoulders. We just give a quick squeeze firmly. And then if that's not working, then we go in for a painful stimulation. So we're going to try and squeeze and mash the shoulders.
In real time, this all happens real fast. They bring out the oxygen tank.
And then from here, we're going to start doing airway interventions. So, because at this point, if somebody hasn't woken up, it's most likely been an opioid overdose, and we're going to have to give them some rescue breaths and some oxygen. So from this point, we're going to tilt the head back, and we're going to pull the jaw up.
During an overdose, the brain's control center, the part that reminds us to breathe, slows down and even turns off. As someone reemerges from that, Tim says the goal is to be as gentle as possible.
We want the person to stay with people who care about them and who are going to watch them. And we respond with kindness.
We're spending time in Vancouver on today's episode of The Pulse because that city has a unique approach to the opioid epidemic. They have a supervised injection site. It's called Insight. It is the first of its kind in North America, and Alana Gordon spent time there to get a sense of the approach and what they're doing. So, Alana, Insight has been around for 15 years. What have they learned? What's been the impact?
Well, there is a lot of documentation and research on this because every detail of this place has been carefully studied since the beginning. That was one of the federal conditions for even opening the place. The main takeaways from several different studies were that people who used Insight were less likely to need emergency care. Overdoses went down around the area, as did outdoor use. It prevented deaths and the spread of HIV. People were also more likely to get recovery services, and that's in part because there's sort of a pipeline built in. There's even this chill room next to that supervised injection space, and peers and social workers are often on hand there to talk.
So that kind of data could be persuasive to cities in the U.S. that are considering this approach, but there's still going to be pushback, I'm imagining. How did people react in Vancouver when Insight was first being debated or talked about?
Well, as Darwin Fisher, Insight's program coordinator, will tell you, Insight was not an easy sell. Far from it.
It was a struggle to get this place set up. It was the struggle of years and lives to get this going.
Let's hear about that history and get back to your reporting from Vancouver.
Insight was designed and pushed into reality by the very people who've used the space. So let's rewind to the late 90s. Vancouver's in the midst of an overdose and HIV crisis.
We had people in the community center, people around the community center, overdosing in bathrooms and all over the neighborhood, and ambulances were appearing.
Donald McPherson was working inside the main community center in Vancouver's downtown east side. He says overdose deaths shot up from a couple dozen to more than 350 a year in the province, partly from a more potent supply of heroin.
And we were doing memorial services in the community center, but every 2 weeks, because this community had been so hard hit.
People were terrified.
Ann Livingston remembers how bad it was, the neglect, the trauma, the loss. They'd hold vigils and rallies.
And these guys would get up there and they'd go, my friends are all dying, because it was like a sinking ship.
She's lived in the neighborhood for decades and was one of the major forces behind organizing a drug user union. They first met in a nearby park. Then they landed their own space, where they even ran an illegal injection site that police would close down. Deaths continued, and that pain turned to passion.
If you're part of something that's progressing, people aren't so depressed. If it's constant deaths, and no matter what you do, you're powerless, that's when you get this really intense trauma. It just adds fuel to the fire.
Well, in the beginning, we had to do a lot of marching.
People like Brian Aline started taking the lead.
I was a hardcore junkie, starving.
I meet up with Brian a few blocks from Insight on his break. He's been working there as a peer since it opened 15 years ago. At the time, Brian had been active in that drug users union.
We had to go to many, many meetings, police board meetings. We had meetings up to the yin-yang.
Brian and other drug users, plus activists with a nonprofit housing group called the Portland Hotel Society, would tell their stories to anyone and everyone who'd listen. City officials, addiction specialists. They wanted a better response and an alternative to shooting up in alleys with dirty water and used needles. They wanted a space where they could safely inject free from harassment. But that was not a popular idea.
Chinatown didn't want this. Gastown didn't want this. Nobody wanted it. Strathcona didn't want this. And these are all areas right next to us. Right here, right there, right there.
The overall concern is that the neighborhood, being the way it is attracting a lot of undesirable people, attracting a lot of undesirable activities, bringing down a plethora of social issues.
Albert Folk is based around the block as the head of the Chinatown Business Association. He says in this community in particular, many people viewed drugs as a criminal act. Sanctioning use, whatever the public health implication, was unacceptable. Opponents organized protests too. Police were wary. Bill Spurn has been with the department for more than two decades.
I thought that supervised consumption sites would act like a magnet to draw people in, almost like a tourist destination where they would come to Vancouver specifically to use drugs.
This concern is often referred to as the honeypot effect. By now, it was the early 2000s. Donald McPherson from the community center had moved into a position at City Hall. He was tasked with drafting drug and addiction policies for the mayor. He worked from the inside to convince leaders to try the approach.
But I just paraded experts in front of the mayor. And the mayor was a very blue pinstripe wearing, right of center, sort of Mayor Philip Owen.
It worked.
He became very interested and started to advocate for change. Because he didn't know what to do.
The opening of a supervised injection site became a defining issue of city elections. And Donald says it wasn't just a downtown east side problem anymore. Families from all over were suffering from the loss of loved ones. Pressure mounted. And finally, in 2003, Vancouver moved forward and opened Insight as a pilot with federal health funding. A key activist group that pushed for it would help run it, and still does. Albert Folk, the nearby business owner, says what came after Insight opened was hard to ignore.
There is clearly a reduction of people shooting up in a back alley. That's not to say there isn't any. There will always be a few, but the number has dropped substantially. We don't see as many discarded syringes as there used to be. But what we haven't seen, and this is a welcoming sight, is that, you know, you don't see people hiding behind your car shooting up.
And there was no signs of a so-called honeypot effect. In other words, the place wasn't encouraging use or drawing more people in that would otherwise be there. Law enforcement warmed up. Bill Spurn, a longtime member of the police department, says before Insight in the 90s, he'd spent entire days going from overdose to overdose. It wore on him. Then that changed.
I mean, I started putting this puzzle together, and you know, I think you mellow as you get older too, and you're able to look at things easier. And it was just, it made sense to me that the reason that there were, you know, the number of overdoses that I was attending or my members were attending had dropped significantly was because of Insight.
But political tension continued. Insight faced major legal battles to secure its place that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. In 2011, Insight won. The court essentially ruled that closing it would undermine people's health and safety. And so it was there to stay, no longer facing a federal threat of closure.
But recent developments overwhelmed what Insight could do.
There's all this good stuff happening, there's great people working, and yet there's so many people dying, it's like the worst ever.
In 2016, a wave of powerful synthetic opioids like fentanyl hit the streets. This is a potent synthetic opioid, much stronger than heroin. It delivers a powerful high. Some drug users seek it out, but often drugs like cocaine or heroin are laced with it, and people are not aware. Because of that, across North America, seasoned drug users and younger ones have been overdosing at unprecedented levels.
I don't think people like realize how dangerous this whole fentanyl thing is.
It's like we don't even have time to mourn one person anymore before the next is dying.
And in Vancouver, this influx overwhelmed the system. In response, supervised injection went to a whole new level. Let's get back to Alana Gordon's reporting from Vancouver and a note. This story includes some descriptions of injection drug use.
By the end of 2016, the death count for all of British Columbia rose to nearly 1,000. More than double the overdose peak of the 90s. Then it tripled. When fentanyl hit hard, Insight was basically the only place for supervised injection. The regulatory and approval process had made it hard for additional places to open. And so while Insight itself was super busy, it's limited. It oversees just a tiny portion of all the drug use in the neighborhood. It could not contain the flood.
I've lost so many people I care about.
This is Tina Shaw. For years, she had a big cocaine addiction. When the overdoses started mounting, she wanted to do something, to get involved.
We weren't going to just stand by and just let people keep dying.
Once again, pain turned to passion.
So that's when we took it into our own hands.
Tina and other advocates went rogue.
We put tents in the alleys.
They went ahead and set up medic tents in the thick of where lots of people were already overdosing. They'd volunteer, standing watch over people injecting with their Narcan and breathing masks at the ready.
Because we care about each other down here.
Tina's a petite redhead with a big presence. She has on a black t-shirt with a phrase printed in big white letters on it that's not suitable for radio.
Hashtag, I don't know how to do that. All those bleep, 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 F fentanyl.
Walking around, you can't get from point A to point B without Tina stopping someone she knows, or someone stopping her.
Oh, thank you, sweetheart.
I love you, Justin.
I love you, Benji.
I love him.
So now we'll get going on the housing
thing. Yeah. Beautiful. See you in the morning, 10 o'clock, knock really loud. Are you okay, honey?
Yeah.
Oh, I just wanted to make sure you weren't overdosing. Sorry, wake you up.
The tents that she and others put up back at the end of 2016, in the middle of where people were overdosing in the downtown east side, they were illegal. But the regional health authority did not shut them down. Leaders visited and decided to fund them, the supplies and the staff. And so the tents got real roofs. They moved indoors. Now there are some 40 sites around the province. Social workers are on hand, but these places are way more informal.
So 116 Hastings.
We're open from 1 o'clock in the afternoon till 11 o'clock at night.
We arrive at the one Tina has been most active in lately. It's called the Molson Overdose Prevention Site. The entrance is in an alley about a block from Insight. But unlike Insight, nurses don't run this place. Peers do.
We're also in active use, most of us. You know, there's something there that exists between, you know, that's why we're peers, right?
Daniel Beaverstock is 42, originally from a small village in Ontario. He's working the check-in counter today.
Jules, I got a table for you. Go ahead. What are you using? Okay.
Like everyone else who works here, Daniel's trained to respond to overdoses. And he's had a lot of close calls himself, if it weren't for people who were around to save him.
And I said, if there's any ever a way I can give back, just ask and I'll do it.
Peers like Daniel work four-hour shifts. The basic rules are they can do whatever they need to do to avoid going into withdrawal, shooting up every 4 hours or so. So when Daniel's not on the clock, he also injects here. But if he or any other peer ever seems too high to do their job, like they're nodding off, then a supervisor sends them home for the day.
All right, so go ahead, table four.
Just past Daniel is a wide open room with eight rectangular metal tables set up along the walls. It's a lot more low-key compared to Insight. People can share booths and even help one another inject. The main no-nos are no money exchanges, so dealers don't set up inside, no physical threats or hitting, and no uncapped rigs or needles to avoid accidental sticks.
Sorry, I'm just going through a really, really rough time right now.
Stephanie Peterson is sitting at booth three. A dear friend died last night.
I need to get my hit, so I hope you don't mind.
Stephanie lights a match to cook up her drugs in a little metal cup. She says it's hard to put this stuff down when you've been using since you were a teen.
What are you doing?
I'm just filling up the needles or the supplies.
Colin, another peer, moves around the room on a constant mission, restocking supplies and cleaning tables when people are done. He says for years, his addiction isolated him, making his world small, so, so very small. Then he says this place hired him.
So I think this job's really helped me to give me a little bit more purpose in my life again. I don't know, so my life's getting better.
Nearby, a man injects in his neck. At one point, another person's pet rat gets loose in the chill-out area. It's a cluster of chairs in the back. It can be a bit erratic in here, with people having good days and bad. Other staff move toward a man in booth 7. He's older, tall and slender, and known to overdose. A supervisor standing nearby says they put an oximeter on his finger. It's a little device that checks heart rate and oxygen levels.
If it's below 90, then we like to give him, put a mask on him, give him air, or try to remind him to breathe.
Moments later, Stephanie walks over to the man. She puts her arm on his shoulder. They're mourning a mutual loss. No one's ever died in any of these more informal sites. The regional health authority basically leveraged a special emergency declaration to greenlight and fund them. It doesn't technically protect people from arrest, but local police are on board. The sites have also taken different forms, like this semi-outdoor space with a big fan in it, where people can smoke drugs.
We call it the smoking and poking room, because you can smoke and you can poke.
Sites have also moved inside homeless shelters and apartment buildings where people would otherwise use alone in their rooms and overdose. A few are up north in rural communities. Recently, downtown business leaders requested a site to prevent overdoses in the bathrooms of their shops. And there's an injection site just for women. What does it mean to have a space like this where you can inject and there's supervision?
It means that we get to be safe and that we're not always alone. We don't have to be alone if we don't want to be. Like, I've been on the streets for 10 years alone.
Trish is in her 20s. I meet her at a smaller site, just four tables. She sits in one corner, emptying her bag of stuff.
So, like, my whole life I've had really nobody to look up to or nobody to stand by my side, and almost everybody in my life's ever hurt me, right? So to have people that are just willing to be the bystander and just make sure that I don't die at the end of the day, it shows me that even though people aren't obligated to, they still care, which is, you know, the biggest thing for me. I just want somebody to not want me to leave, you know.
Trish takes a good 15 minutes at least, prepping her drugs.
I'm just making sure it's all dissolved up, right?
She searches for a spot on her arm. She gently pushes the needle in.
Okay.
That's crazy.
Even with these new spaces, people are still dying in the region. This spring, an even more potent batch of synthetics made its way into the drug supply here. Vancouver experienced one of its worst months yet for overdose deaths. But the health authority estimates the count would be much, much higher without these sites. People like Sue Willette, another supervisor at the Molson Overdose Prevention Site, are on high alert. On a walk across the street, she spotted a man overdosing in the alley.
He just sort of slumped on the wall down to a crouched position, and he was purple. So we got him in a prone position and gave him Narcan, inserted an airway and breathed for him.
She and someone else nearby jumped in right away. It was a complicated resuscitation. They got him back.
Of course, he was just coming up as the fire department arrived, which is wonderful.
How are you feeling?
It's kind of hard to describe because you get this wicked adrenaline rush and you're so focused on what you have to do that you don't think about anything else. It's like literally everything around you just disappears and you have that person in front of you. Once the adrenaline is over and he's standing up or sitting up and is able to talk, that big rush is gone. And then you think about, had it been 1 or 2 minutes that we hadn't gotten there, he wouldn't be alive. And here's the code for them: yellow for fellow, green for gal.
Moments later, Sue's back to work. The red we don't use this time, training a new peer and using the oxygen machine and the breathing masks. So more people are ready to respond, to lessen the harm of an overdose and prevent more deaths.
This is hooked up to the machine. Now, when we're getting to the point where we have a full-on overdose and the person's unconscious on the floor, we have them lying on their back.
Right.
We have them, this is where the second person on your overdose team comes in. We're going to
insert the airway.
Okay, now there's three different airways in here.
We've been spending time in Vancouver getting a sense of their approach to overdose deaths with Alana Gordon reporting. Alana, these supervised injection sites are popping up all over the city. It sounds like they are preventing deaths, but it also sounds like they can't keep up.
It's been really difficult, and that has some leading doctors in Canada taking what you might call an even more extreme approach.
We have to give people drugs.
That's Mark Tyndall. He is a physician with the region's Center for Disease Control, and he's been on the forefront of studying supervised injection. He says the drug supply is so deadly right now that people just straight up need access to a safer, regulated supply.
So come into a supervised site. Don't bother spending 2 or 3 hours trying to hustle some drugs. Just come in straight. Here's the drugs. Use them. And then now you've just freed yourself up a few hours. Maybe you can work on something else.
Hold on. They are prescribing heroin to people?
That is exactly what they're doing, prescribing pharmaceutical-grade heroin and other prescription opioids. There's been a clinic across the street from Insight that's been piloting this for years, and the city's trying to expand that.
But that sounds a little crazy, like they are now actively enabling drug use.
What Mark Tyndall would say is that people are already using drugs, and if the addiction treatments that were available worked for everyone and everyone was able to take them and use them and it got them off drugs, great, but that's not the reality. And so given that, while the drug supply is so tainted, the idea is to keep people safe and stabilize them so they don't die and have them be connected with care, even if that also means giving them the drugs directly.
All right, well, thank you, Alana.
Thanks, Mikan.
Thank you. communities everywhere are trying to figure out how to best respond to the opioid epidemic. But when Chicago reporter Lakhidra Chavis started looking into the drug crisis in her city, she found a huge group of people struggling with addiction who seemed to be largely overlooked and left out of conversations about who's at risk and who needs help.
Chicago is a city known for its gun violence. But more people are actually dying from opioid-related overdoses. For African Americans in the city, the overdose death rate is 3 times the national average. And it's Chicago's West Side, home to a large portion of the city's Black residents, that have seen the highest rates of overdoses. On a recent afternoon, I walked the Austin neighborhood with Kenneth Baldry. Kenneth says Black users usually two. That's when you snort heroin, not inject it.
You can ask maybe 10 people. And you say, well, who do you think overdosed the most in Chicago? And they'll tell you, white people, because they shoot, and we too. But that's not true.
Kenneth does outreach and tries to teach people in the community about naloxone, the medication that can reverse an opioid overdose. It's a solution that's been propped up repeatedly in the opioid epidemic. But some local advocates worry that Black users aren't accessing naloxone, which is usually handed out by prevention workers in its syringe form. They say this could be for a lot of reasons. Black users who snort might be less likely to go to needle exchanges, they might be uncomfortable using needles at all, or it could simply be about awareness. So Kenneth is part of a team of former and current heroin users spreading the word. He's been clean for a little over a year.
This is like the heaviest part of our neighborhood, that's where they sell drugs in every direction. I've been over here for maybe 20 years. I did everything over here.
He's got a large drawstring bag filled with naloxone kits and starts to show me how the medicine works.
What we do is we'll take them out. Hello. There's a young lady that I saw this morning that I gave one to.
Not long into our conversation, a small group forms. Kenneth, his friend Cynthia, Marilyn, her friend Kim, most of whom are current users. Kenneth's naloxone outreach and lessons seem to be working.
You think they might be ODing, they ODing, and they not. It won't even work on them. It's just like water because it only affects the opiate.
But when I ask why more people aren't carrying naloxone around with them, the women echo lots of things I've heard from other Black users I've spoken with. In these communities, where police are more present, one big barrier is fear. Fear that Black users might be targeted for carrying syringes, that naloxone, to the untrained eye, can look like illicit drug paraphernalia.
The bottom line is to get it out here in our neighborhood, so when somebody fall out right there on this corner, how many times somebody fell out on this corner? 100 times.
Man, my goodness.
We'll have it there already. Right. And we'll know how to use
it. So I think it shouldn't be no problem with nobody sitting up there carrying that around, especially if it's going to save a life.
They say it shouldn't be a problem, but they fear it will be. So, some African Americans in Chicago are hesitant to use what public health folks say is one of the biggest weapons against overdose deaths. As Kenneth, his friend Cynthia, and I keep walking, Kenneth points out the spots where his friends fatally overdosed a few months back. Heroin has been a problem here for a long time. But the women say folks just started paying attention when it hit the suburbs. And Kenneth says now that summer's here, things are about to get worse.
There's going to be enough people dying from shootings and all this rest of stuff. We don't need nobody ODing, you know. It's something we can prevent.
Still on the West Side, just one neighborhood over, is a place I've thought about a lot. When you look at Chicago's overdoses on a map, the high concentration of deaths here lights up at a place called the JR Plaza Hotel. The rooms can be rented by the hour and are small, dingy, and roach-infested. What this place means to people depends on who you ask. Children live here, and sometimes you can hear them running up and down the hall. I first noticed this place as a data point in a spreadsheet, but then a few months ago, I booked a room, and the reality of the place became real and piercing. I'm at the JR Plaza Hotel in West Garfield Park. My hotel window overlooks Washington Boulevard, and the light from the hotel sign is shining into my room. And I'm here because this hotel is near the epicenter of a cluster of opioid-related drug deaths on Chicago's West Side. In the past 3 years, 10 people have fatally overdosed here. Jose Soberanes in room 106, Charles Boykin in room 110, Kyle Townsend in room 202, just next door, Anatoly Nelson in room 204, Thomas Knight in room 214, Earlis Ross, 221, Danny Williams, 222, Michael Sims in room 229, James Radinsky in 305, and Marina Shibe. Their deaths have gone mostly unnoticed. The people who died here ranged in age from 21 to 71. Most of them were Black men. Most died alone. Kyle Townsend was 33 when he fatally overdosed in room 202. He died from a mix of heroin, fentanyl, and cocaine. Kyle was a tall, stocky guy from the neighborhood and a single parent, a daughter who's now in her early teens. I spoke to Kyle's mom, Jocelyn, a few days before the one-year anniversary of Kyle's death.
I was in Chicago visiting my mom, visiting him, and he didn't look right to me. And I said, well, as soon as I get home, I'm going to send for you to come down here, and I was going to get you into rehab. And before I got a chance to do that, he OD'd. I hope as it gets better, I hope no one else's child has to suffer, no other parent has to feel what I feel, you know, because it's really hard. What they say, you're never supposed to bury your child. My child's supposed to bury me, you know. Okay, I'm done, because now I'm starting to get emotional.
Just a few blocks over is the neighborhood park. That's where I meet up with Kathy Kane Willis. She's been researching the opioid epidemic in Illinois for more than a decade and now works for the Chicago Urban League. As we walk through the park, she starts picking up empty dime bags.
How many bags do you have there?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
10.
And that's just the ones that were interesting that I picked up. I mean, if I had picked them all up, I probably would have had 100.
And we keep finding them. All different sizes and designs, identifiers sellers use to brand their products. The 700-plus people that died from opioids last year in Chicago did so from mostly heroin and fentanyl, often bought on the streets in bags just like the ones we picked up. Kathy says this is the reality of Chicago's opioid epidemic. She says addiction to street drugs isn't viewed with the same amount of sympathy. Kathy says people who have an addiction journey that begins with painkillers tend to elicit more compassion.
It's a nice story to tell. Your family doesn't hate you maybe as much. You know, society can look on you not as angrily.
In this city, Black communities face systemic barriers. Aside from poverty and disinvestment, lawmakers have slashed state funding for treatment over the past decade, leaving few treatment clinics on the West Side in particular. The bottom line is, what's happening in Chicago is a lot different from a national narrative that's focused largely on white communities and addiction that starts with prescription painkillers. When I spoke with one treatment provider on the West Side, she told me that people on this side of town feel erased from a reality they've been dealing with for decades.
Lakhidra Chavis reported the story, a version of it, first aired on WBEZ in Chicago. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we've been talking about opioids. As communities try to find ways to combat this epidemic, it's important to remember why people use drugs, says psychiatrist Lloyd Sederer.
These drugs are highly effective, powerful, immediate. They solve problems for people. They take away physical pain. They take away emotional pain, or they may simply transport somebody to a place that's a lot better than the grind that they're in. That's why people use drugs, and that's where we have to start if we're going to make a difference in this epidemic.
Lloyd says historically in the U.S., we've used control and consequences as the main ways to fight back against addiction. Control the supply, punish selling and use, and try to scare people away from using drugs.
Rather than saying, this has to do with the person, this has to do with the way that person hurts, and we have to approach it that way.
But we keep using those two approaches, control and consequences, over and over.
Yes, Winston Churchill said you can rely on Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. And we're still on the trying everything else. There are some example spots here and there, state efforts, city efforts, to approach the problem, this epidemic, in a public health way, but they haven't reached the scale that we need.
Where do you suggest we start in terms of tackling this issue?
First, prevention. Then screening, early identification of the problem, the sooner the better with any disease. And then finally, good treatment. And good treatment is really hard to find because good treatment does intervene at various levels of the brain. It's not a reliance on one approach alone.
Treatment for opioid addictions should include both medication and therapy, says Lloyd. He also advocates for more screening for depression and anxiety, which are both linked to addiction. Sometimes it feels like this crisis, this opioid epidemic is so big, it feels insurmountable. What would it take to make a difference?
It can seem like a big problem, but every big problem can be broken down. And our country has had one success after another with epidemics, and this is an epidemic. Think of polio. Think of cholera, how we beat back the tobacco epidemic. We can do this. And what worked was a public health approach, which was prevention, and then detecting the disease, developing treatments for them. And we have all of those elements for the opioid disorders. It's just that we're not employing them adequately.
Lloyd Sederer is a psychiatrist. His new book is called The Addiction Solution, Treating Our Dependence on Opioids and Other Drugs. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhurov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tung. Our intern is Mike Mascarelli. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is the editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. Supporting The Pulse, the Coriell Institute for Medical Research, enabling scientific discovery around the world through its renowned collections of cell lines and DNA from the National Institute on Aging and National Institute for General Medical Sciences. Learn more at coriell.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.